Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, we talk with Leah Cohen about her new novel, The Grief of Others.
I think I grew up being aware of sadness in history and sadness globally, though it had never come so close to home in the way that it has now after September 11th.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Adam Gopnik and Pamela Paul discuss the art of children's books and the art of writing about them.
You want someone, obviously, who is attuned to readers of that age and knows what is sort of works and is appropriate.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Leah Cohen is one of America's best novelists and one of our outstanding chroniclers of domestic life in this country. Her new novel is called The Grief of Others. It's reviewed by Suzanne Kochel on the cover of this week's book review. And she says, Cohen is a master of the mundane complexities, nuanced tragedies, and unexpected tendernesses of human life, and that in her new novel, she weaves a complex pattern of light and dark, happiness and grief. I'm delighted that Leah Cohen is joining us today to talk about her novel. Welcome, Leah.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have a novel that begins with kind of a horrific, but not altogether uncommon event. Why don't you describe that?
The mother in the novel, Ricky, gives birth to a baby who lives for 57 hours. He has a congenital condition, which means he cannot live. And it's maybe horrific, but it's also so normal. You know, many people have miscarriages and we all die. So there is a kind of mundane quality to the sadness.
And Leah, just so readers understand, this is explained very early. In fact, it's a prologue to the novel. Then we see the family at a later stage reforming itself with a new generation of children and a husband and wife who were haunted by this event.
I feel so much affection for these people, for the four members of this family. Because they don't do a very good job for a long time of healing or even of figuring out the best way to mourn. And I think that's so understandable. You know, I think we're all clods a lot of the time. And I find that really interesting, the ways in which we stumble and can be cloddish in our interactions.
And also, Leah, the closed doors that exist even between people who are as close as you might assume people could ever be.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I grew up in a family, I think, where I didn't feel like there was a whole lot of privacy in my family or a big premium on secrets and privateness. And so maybe for that reason, I'm interested in how secrets and privacy and privateness plays out in families.
Leah, I have to say this because I'm from Tarrytown, New York, across the Hudson River from Rockland County, where this novel is set. You grew up there in Nyack, I think. Why don't you talk a little bit about life in the Hudson Valley, how it's different, say, from living in New York City or from what people might assume suburban New York life is like?
I moved to Nyack when I was 7, and I had lived in Queens before that. And so I was young enough that I still spent a lot of formative years growing up in Nyack. But because I didn't spend my whole childhood there, I think I related to it a little bit as someone coming in from the outside. It seemed other, and it seemed wonderfully strange to me. I remember when we first got there, I remember riding my bike around Nyack and really feeling like I was riding around inside a dream or inside a book. Without trying to sound too mystical, my childhood sense of Nyack was that it was a kind of magical place. Even though it's close to New York City, there's an oldness, there's a feeling of slippage between a very modern kind of reality and a sense of an older, haunted feeling that the Hudson Valley has.
So much of that is the result of this magnificent river that flows through. And there are scenes in the novel. There's a lovely park on your side, what used to be your side of the river, that runs along it. And there you almost feel as if you are entering the America of the Hudson River School or something of an earlier time.
Yes, that's true. And this doesn't come out in the book, but, I mean, growing up in Nyack, I was aware of Edward Hopper and all of the artists and musicians and performers and writers who have thrived in Nyack and around Nyack. And then right across the river, you know, we'd look at those dark green hills and think about Sleepy Hollow and Ichabod Crane. And one summer when I was 17, I worked at Sunnyside, which is Washington Irving's old house. And I wore a hoop skirt and a bonnet and I gave tours. And I was pretty enraptured by the sense of doubleness of time in the Hudson Valley.
Leah, let me ask you something more directly related to the novel. As Suzanne Kochel says, you're particularly interested in the dynamics of the family. Here we are at a moment 10 years after the September 11 attacks, and there's been so much coverage and memorialization of that. Are we at a moment where a novelist like yourself, primarily interested in the interactions among members of a family, also has to be aware of the larger world you inhabit? And are those characters aware of it too as they go through the motions of their lives?
You know, I don't know, Sam, if that's more true today in the wake of September 11th than it was before. Even as a little child, I think I was oddly attuned to sadness, not just the sadness I knew or that was close to me, but I think I grew up being aware of sadness in history and sadness globally. And though it had never come so close to home in the way that it has now after September 11th, I think that didn't mean it wasn't there. And it didn't feel burdensome to me, but it felt important to attend to. So I guess the answer is, yes, I think there's an imperative to have a sense of, you know, vast grieving and sadness and how much that's shared throughout the world. But I'm not sure that for me, I experienced that imperative more greatly today than before September 11th.
Thanks so much, Leah.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Leah Hager-Cohen, whose new novel, The Grief of Others, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So you're back from court and the big Google case has reached a new phase?
Yes, we had another development in the longstanding plan of Google's to build a huge digital library. So far, they've scanned 15 million books, an effort that began back in 2004. And today, the parties all met in court again after they've been negotiating all summer long, trying to come up with a new settlement after the judge rejected the revised settlement that came out in March.
And the settlement has to do with what, with royalties to authors or fees owed to publishers or both, something entirely different?
The basic issue and what the original lawsuits came from is that Google had started scanning all these books and publishers and authors wanted to stop it because they said that Google was violating copyright.
Right. If you put my book on Google, then somebody else is not going to buy it. You've actually taken the property away from me.
Google's response was that it was fair use because for copyrighted books, they were only posting snippets of the books. But then it became a larger issue of, you know, what Google should be allowed to do, what a private company can do with a lot of books, which they call orphan works, who really have no owner that anyone can find.
And what did the judge decide?
So today was the third status conference of the summer, or now I guess we're into the fall. And Judge Denny Chin, who's been hearing this case for many years, had told the parties involved back in July that they really needed to speed up their negotiations. He was getting very impatient. He said, this case has dragged on for 6 years now, and since I've rejected the first settlement you've come to, I want you to come up with something else. So the parties came into court today and they said, we've made a lot of progress, but we're not there yet. And Judge Chin did what he said he was going to do back in July, which was begin the schedule which could take the case to trial next year. Now, the parties can still negotiate while that schedule moves forward, while they do discovery, while they submit preliminary briefs. But for now, it does look like they are on a tentative schedule to go to trial sometime in the middle of next year.
So they just can't work out a negotiation, or not one the judge will approve. Do we know why he rejected the earlier agreement?
He said that it went too far and that by requiring authors to opt out of having their rights used by Google instead of opting in, it turned copyright law on its head. So he sent them back to the table. He said that he would accept an opt-in arrangement, but Google has all but dismissed that as unworkable. So for all of the parties now, it's back to the drawing board.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Readers of the Book Review will have noticed, I hope, that in recent months we've been giving more and more attention to children's books. And that is all the doing of my colleague Pamela Paul, who is here to talk about this week's issue and some of the really important books covered in it. And she's joined by one of the best writers alive on children's literature, The New Yorker's great Adam Gopnik. I welcome them both.
Good to be here.
Let me start you off with a question. I'll just throw it out to both of you. Maybe Pamela, because there you are. When you are assigning a book like Wonderstruck, which is a major new novel in words and pictures reviewed by Adam, is that different from the way someone like me might look for a reviewer for Jonathan Franzen's new novel or collection of short stories by Alice Munro? Are you weighing very highly literary questions? Are you thinking of the audience? What is the process you go through?
Well, I think everything that you would go through for a regular book review. And then there are additional qualifications or considerations. You want someone, obviously, who is attuned to readers of that age and knows what is sort of works and is appropriate, what a book is for a four-year-old. It's very different for a 10-year-old. And a book that's meant to be read aloud is very different from a book that a 17-year-old is going to be reading to themselves alone at night.
Let me turn to Adam for a moment. You've written, no surprise to our readers, an exquisite, thoughtful, nuanced review of Wonderstruck. It's a book published for readers, according to the legend here, as we call it, ages 9 to 12. But is the review also written for their parents? Is it written for librarians? Is it written for someone like me who should know about this author when he doesn't?
I think more the last than anything else, Sam. I mean, for the youth of the world, in the sense that here's a wonderful artist, Brian Selznick, whose book, The Invention of Hugo Cabret, struck some of us, independent of our kids reading it or not reading it, although my kids happen to love it, as just a new visionary, in the same way that we were struck by Chris Van Allsburg when Van Allsburg first came up and said, here's somebody with this beautiful poetic gift, way of marrying dreamlike images and enigmatic words. And said, this guy is a fabulous writer, just a plain fabulous writer, no matter what category you'd put him into.
I think what Harry Potter showed all readers of all ages was something that some people, some adults knew all along, which is that really good children's literature really works at all ages. And that's what, you know, I would say is true with Brian Selznick, with Wonderstruck. It's also true of the writers who I talk about in the Back Page Essay this week, Shel Silverstein, Maury Sendak, Dr. Seuss. These are books that adults enjoy along with their children. And it's really adults who are buying these books.
What about, Adam and Pamela, the question of relevance over time? There are some wonderful adult writers whose work ages a little bit or dates. Is this an issue also in
children's literature?
I would say less so. I think, again, first of all, it's parents who are often buying the books, and they, with children's literature, the backlist is extremely strong because parents want to read to their children the books that they grew up reading.
I think that's true. I also think it's the case that there's an element of, what can we call it, purposeful timelessness in the best children's literature. They're not journalistic responses to the passing scene in the way that the novel at its best often is, the grown-up novel. At the same time, one of the things that struck me reading the Selznick and thinking about it was that it's very much a book of our time. Now, it's not set in our time. It's set in a more remote time. I mean, even in the 1970s and then with a wonderful, beautifully articulated visual flashback to the 1920s. But it seemed to me that the kind of the love of mystery, the relish of the reverie, you know, children's books like From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Bazley Frankweiler, which Selznick references and refers to, were very much about sort of the pragmatics of living in the past. You know, how do you cope with this crazy grown-up world? And so many of the good children's books that we see now, the most beautiful, Kate DiCamillo's books, for instance, are about how do you find a refuge from a deeply confusing universe. This book is very much about that, about healing and embracing, about accepting mysteries as part of life. So in that way, though, I think that children's books seek a kind of timelessness that maybe the novel proper doesn't always. They bear the imprint of their time in a very moving and often very complicated way.
Right. And also, I mean, with a lot of children's classics, you have to remember that childhood, for those who are going through it, everything is magical, everything is mysterious, everything is in a way new. So even if you're reading something that might be on the surface a bit outdated, even when Jumanji, for example, was published, the book about the board game that comes to life, nobody was leaving two children alone in a house and for the afternoon without a babysitter even then. It was set in this sort of, you know, this kind of perfect world of no grown-ups that didn't exist then, perhaps never existed, but can feel very real and at the same time wondrous to children.
Pamela, but you also say in your back page essay that these three great children's books, writers of an earlier generation, Sendak, Seuss, and Silverstein, were subversive in some way. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that there's always this tension in children's literature. You want books that are somehow going to magically teach your child to be the ideal child that you would want them to be. At the same time, they have to be realistic enough so that it conveys their experience in a way they can relate to. But I think that books before these three writers really were more set in the former world of, you know, children should sit properly at the dinner table and not
feed the dog. Didactic.
Exactly. And what Silverstein and Sendak and Seuss did was not only portray children as they really are, which is often, you know, slovenly and ill-mannered and messy and horrible, but they said that that's okay. No one got punished for it. I mean, most famously in Where the Wild Things Are,
exactly, yeah.
Max is a monster, and he still gets his dinner, and yeah, it's still hot.
When my own older child was about four, he loved Where the Wild Things Are, and what he would say whenever he'd say, what would you like to read tonight? He'd say, I want a book with boats. I want a book with boats. And it was exactly the idea of escape, that Max goes on that boat, and he goes to the land of the wild things. He gets the boat back as well, which is an important part, place where the fables of children's literature differ from grown-up literature. We send our characters off on boats, and they never come back sometimes. So that, I think, is part of it. But do you feel, as I do, Pamela, that there's a slight shift in mood? Part of the excitement of the early Dr. Seuss or of Shel Silverstein's a little bit different, isn't he? Because The Giving Tree is this weird allegory of,
yes,
of something or other, but it's about this self-annihilation of an adult on behalf of kids, which is true, but maybe is different. But certainly Sendak is all about sending the boat out with the kids on it. But I felt the Selznick book, beautiful as it is very much about the boat coming home. It's all about reconciliation. A deaf boy in the 1970s discovers a long-lost deaf connection from the past. It's very much about resolving those mysteries rather than subverting the rules.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I talked to Maurice Sendak over the summer about his new book, Bumbalardi, as well as some of the classics. And he said that what is so important in all of his books is that at the end of the escape, at the end of the fantasy, that they come home. and that everybody is safe.
The boat comes
and
back.
And that the boat comes back, and their mother still loves them, and it's all okay. And so even a book that's as terrifying as Outside Over There, where a girl is watching her baby sister, and the baby sister is carried away by goblins, it all ends well. And that's key to a good work of children's literature.
Yes, you want reconciliation at the end, even if, as in, say, in the, you know, the greatest of all children's books, in the Alice books, what you remember is the cards flying up and the disruption and the madness.
Right.
Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Pamela
Thank you.
Paul, Adam Gopnik, who both contributed essays to this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
How you doing, Sam?
What's new on the list this week?
Well, on the fiction list, James Patterson tops the list. He debuts at number one, no big surprise there, with the new book, Kill Me If You Can, that he co-wrote with Marshall Karp. Over on the nonfiction side, the number one is also a debut. It's Dick Cheney's memoir, In My Time.
Greg, Cheney was kind of a secretive guy during his years as vice president. Has he been out promoting his book at all?
He's been promoting the book quite a lot. He's made the rounds of all the Sunday talk shows, the usual suspects. He's still been pretty circumspect in terms of, you know, it's not a very reflective book. He uses it to settle some scores and to defend his own record in office. Appearing on CNN, talking to Wolf Blitzer, Blitzer tried to get him to acknowledge, you know, any mistakes he might have made in office. He just ducked the question and ducked the question and finally went all the way back to, well, you know, I was kicked out of Yale a couple of times when I was a student there. Blitzer said, really, nothing while you were vice president? He said, I've said all I'm going to say about it.
Well, ever since then, a blameless life. Greg, you recently wrote a very nice profile of Tom Perata, author of The Leftovers, whose new novel is on the bestseller list. Has Perata become now a reliable bestselling author?
He has made the list with now each of his last three novels. Besides The Leftovers, Little Children and The Abstinence Teacher both had brief runs on the hardcover list. When I talked to him, I went to his house in Belmont, Massachusetts, and had lunch with him and his wife. I know he appeared on your podcast a couple of weeks ago, so you know he's a genuinely nice guy and also very thoughtful and articulate about his work. And one of the things that didn't make it into my profile, but that's pertinent to the bestseller list, is he said while he's writing a novel, he doesn't tend to read literary fiction because he doesn't want to be too influenced by it, but he reads a lot of genre fiction. And he takes away from that the importance of story and how important it is to have something pulling you through a novel. He said, I've definitely accepted the aesthetic principle that you should be more interested toward the end of a book than you are in the beginning, which is not always the case with literary fiction.
Oh, that's interesting. So the reader, he means, should be more interested. The reader wants to know how it's going to end.
That's right. In fact, one novel, a literary novel that he said has pulled that off recently was Colm Tóibín's Brooklyn, which he said just had him flipping ahead to the end to see which of two consequential choices the woman who's the protagonist of that book would make.
Another surprising thing about Perata, which you mentioned in your profile, is while many of us still think of him as a humorous or comic writer, the subjects of his books have actually gotten darker over time.
Yeah, he started out as a comic novelist and used to think of himself as a comic novelist, but he said that the more that he's written and just the more that he's lived, the harder he has thinking that there's always a comic element to life if you just look hard enough. You know, he still definitely has kind of an optimist's outlook and always a great eye for the quirky comic detail. But his books have gotten darker and more complicated as his career has progressed.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.